Hello, glorious listeners. Welcome to episode 86 of Rack Addicts After Hours once again from our favourite pub. And having just briefed him on the format of this podcast, I'm going to shake it up and do exactly not what I told him we were going to do. So, Peter's with me, and you will be greeted soon by the voice of Terry, a good friend and colleague of ours from the Shippity Shop that we're sitting next to. I have a question for you. And as, of course, I always do, they're rambly, unfocused, and strange. Maybe. I want to talk about genres, music genres. I'm always in that position with what I listen to. I say, oh yeah, it's kind of proggy, it's metally fusion, and there's some tablas in there, because why not? You know, this rambling conversation to try and describe what I listen to. So, I'm used to having to describe that kind of thing really weirdly and in a roundabout fashion. My questions are, is genre an extension of the language of music theory? So when we're talking about music, trying to describe music, there's always that quote where it's like dancing about the weather, talking about music. But is genre a useful tool in that regard? And how much do you think, that's for you, Pete, as well, how much do you think we need to talk about the origins of the communities that spawn certain genres? I'm thinking, of course, of early jazz. If you think about blues, how much is where that genre has come from? How much of that is still relevant when you're trying to describe music? Your thoughts on that rambling, non-focused question? Because I was thinking about it in the car, listening to some of that proggy, metally, fusiony, weird stuff that I can't describe. What do you reckon? Here's Terry for you.
Hi, thanks for the invite, first of all.
Yeah, you don't get to start easy on this show.
That's a very good question. I believe culture is very important when it comes to music. It permeates music genre, and it's very important to have an awareness of where the type of music that you are either writing or listening to comes from.
So potentially trying to separate them is a fool's errand.
Most likely. It's a very good tool if you're trying to direct yourself creatively towards a genre. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I believe maybe yes, it might be false to try and separate them.
You are a composer yourself.
Yes, indeed.
How often do you have a client potentially that will go, this is your genre, here you are, fixed in a horrible box of something very specific, and they know what's in their head? How often does that happen to you and you think, oh, I just want to, there's this neighbouring thing, I want to bring it in? How often do you find yourself blending between and navigating different genres?
So that happens all the time. Most of the time, briefs that publishers will provide you with are very, very restrictive because they have a very specific idea of what they want. And a lot of the time, they'll give you the instrumentation they want. They'll give you references, very specific references. Sometimes it might be songs from the same composer or artist that they want you to sound like. So it can be very, very restrictive.
So you're writing for music libraries?
Primarily.
How often do you just get a pretty blank brief? We need this piece of music and here are your bits. How often would you have the opportunity to compose? Actually, they give you the piece of film to work with and it's quite free form.
For libraries, it's very unlikely that you'll get any video. Primarily because they want to sell want to sell the material to as many channels or as many videographers as possible. So a lot of the time you're working on a list, a specific list.
Thank you for indulging in my poorly thought out and rambly questions. Next time they will be less focused and more rambly, and it'll be even weirder.
Better.
Now we can go into the weekly update. I'm going to selfishly kick this one off because last weekend I thought it would be a good idea to go on a 30-mile bike ride. It was a really good one. And then also I managed to find a place to play some squash again, which I haven't done. Squash, if you haven't played it before, is the best sport in the world. Fight me later. But big long bike ride and lots of squash, and I haven't played in a couple of years, and I'm still feeling it really bad. I can't really walk properly at the moment. Hamstrings don't work. That was pretty much my week.
What hurts the most?
It's hamstrings, because I've always had the least flexible hamstrings possible. And I don't know, my lower back, I couldn't figure out how to stretch it. So yeah, it's a weird one. So cycling and squash, that's been me. But Pete, what have you been up to?
I've been getting into the studio a bit. But I was going to talk about what I'm going to be doing tomorrow.
A future weekly update.
It does reference back to something we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. So I was saying a couple of weeks ago that I had found some field recordings that I'd done on a trip to London. So we had the train noise, Waterloo Station, atrium, tube, and a bit of the atrium at the British Museum.
Yes, I remember.
So I've been auditing that and editing it down, rendering it down to load it all into the radio music.
Ah, nice one.
To integrate into the performance I'm trying to develop, and hopefully we'll be doing it at the ModCaf.
8th of September.
I know, you keep reminding me.
Yep. Cool. The Eventbrite thing, I scheduled a post. The Eventbrite is up. You can go and book your place now. I want to hear it.
Is that the first one in a while?
This will be the second one, actually. We didn't quite publicise the first one because we thought, some of the, our mates can come, the regulars. But radio music is quite an interesting one, Terry. This is a Eurorack module that Pete and I are very fond of. A really small module, you chuck in an SD card with samples, and instead of just picking a sample, playing one shots, you have the top knob's called Station, I think.
Yeah, it's the tuning.
Yeah, and that picks your sample, but it doesn't tell you when you're at a new sample, very obviously. You just kind of tune through to find a sample. There's a start point and a reset. So radio music is kind of like tuning into a radio of all the samples. And I imagine what you're going to do is you're going to try and make those loop, those ambiences.
So I've been auditing the whole of that recording, but unfortunately you get these really good pieces. And then myself and the friend I was with made the mistake of starting to have conversations on the really good bits. So tomorrow I'm going to recreate the whole journey. I'm going with another friend, and we're going to go to Waterloo up on the train, and then we're going to take the tube and go to the British Museum. So we're going to go to all the venues that we recorded before, but we're going to make the point of concentrating on recording without speaking all over it, so that I've got some really clean. Previously, when I did it, it was a bit of an experiment, as you do with these things, a bit of a laugh, just point the recorder at whoever or whatever. But now I actually know exactly what I want to capture. So I've got a kind of itinerary of, we're going to go here and I want to get this much, this many minutes, go to the next stage, get this sound, get these sliding doors, get this, get that. Get all those wonderful sounds.
You're going to bring a sort of tripod arrangement of anything, so you can just pop it down and leave it for a bit?
Use a Tascam DR07, but an early one. So I've had it for about 10 years, but it's perfectly fine and serviceable. And I use a dead cat on it as well, because that really, really helps. But I've got it on one of those Roycott suspension kind of handles.
Handling noise is really bad on the H5.
The handle has got a large, thick, foamy neoprene handle itself. And then there's a kind of suspension shock absorber just below the actual whole recording unit. So there's no kind of handling noise getting into the recorder. And as I say, the dead cat really does help. Even in large indoor spaces, there are breezes.
Oh, yeah.
You get that terrible shearing effect in the recording.
Any sneak peeks on what might accompany these once they're in the radio music?
Well, I'm working heavily with the Rings, Clouds, and the FX Aid.
Oh, nice. And, definitely then, ambient then.
And then really getting manipulated with the DivKit LFO, the 8 LFO. The Oct.
Awesome.
And I'm getting some really good results from that. And also working with the chainsaw.
Oh, cool. That would be a primary melody kind of situation there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure because I've actually spat an item out. So the Belgrad has left the configuration because I'm not actually using it. I mean, I'm obviously going to keep it.
And you're going for moon phase for your
filter. Well, the moon phase is stereo and that's doing what it needs to do. But the Belgrad isn't doing anything at all within that particular configuration. The Batumi is proving very useful, but as the Belgrad's monophonic, effectively, it hasn't really found a role as yet.
No worries. Well, speaking of modular, while we're on that, I have a reply from Akira. I think this was, might have been last episode or the one before. We were talking about, it was, because we had Tom. We were talking about phase-related filtery situations.
Yes. With the Dr. Octo.
Exactly. Dr. Octature. I have a message here. RE Dr. Octature, combining different slopes are different phases, allows you to get all sorts of non-low-pass filters, notches, bandpass, all-pass, and phasers. So it is similar to the kind of weirdness you can get out for Belgrad if you want. And quadrature LFOs, you can do multi-channel cross-fading, wave morphing, and apparently quadrature oscillators are also used with frequency shifters. Akira bringing the knowledge as always.
Had you asked them the question or did they listen to the podcast?
Avid listener. It's the weekend relaxing. It's great we have our little consistent listeners. And of course, if you do listen to us weekly, thank you so much. most importantly, please find us on Instagram and Facebook at Rack Addicts UK. Let us know you're there. We'd like to talk to you. Terry, what have you been up to this week? Any projects you're working on, music you're listening to? What have you been up to?
At the moment, I have been writing a lot of orchestral music. I recently purchased some really cool plugins by Embertone.
No bells at all. Who are they?
They are I believe a UK-based company. I'm not too sure. They were doing a really great deal on a solo violin plugin and a solo cello plugin. And it has been so far the most real sounding violin sound you can actually get.
Nice. Ember, E-M-B-E-R, like
E-M-B-E-R-T-O-N-E, Embertone.
Nice. Embertone, cool.
And yeah, it's fascinating what you can do without a musician present nowadays. Yeah. It's insane.
With your workflow, do you end up playing that kind of stuff in with a keyboard and then maybe tweaking? Because obviously on plugins you can pick different expression options and things like that. What's your workflow for doing this kind of thing?
I would usually start by actually playing it in on the MIDI controller because it gives it the element of performance. Yep. I'm not a great keyboard player, but it does actually help if you can play the part. And then eventually I would edit the parts and make them sound a bit more clear.
Any of the highlights in your orchestral composition repertoire, in terms of plugins anyway?
Any of the highlights?
Just your favourites.
My favourite plugins.
For the orchestral stuffs.
Ooh, well,
you're a Spitfire man.
Spitfire Audio are so great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love the BBC Symphony Orchestra stuff that they've done. But again, Native Instruments, I use them quite a bit. And they have more options, I'd say, when it comes to articulation and stuff. But it doesn't sound as good as BBC Symphony Orchestra Audio.
Oh, we are blessed to have some pretty serious orchestras, even outside of the recording industry, the orchestras themselves.
Absolutely.
We're furnished well in the UK. But yeah, anything apart from the orchestral composition you've been
up to? That's what I've been working on recently, and I've been practicing a lot of guitar because I've missed it. I haven't really played for such a long time, and I've really been enjoying getting back into it.
So do you still find a focused practice is still an escape for you, or do you just noodle and that's the fun?
It depends. It usually starts with a noodle. Then I realize that I've forgotten some of my skill. And then it becomes a focus practice because I think I've got to get better at this.
Nice.
And it's the same with composition.
Yeah.
You'll start writing something that you want to just sit down and write. And then eventually you realize that you're restricted by your own knowledge. And then you try and kind of practice composing and then go back to the basics with theory, go back to the basics with instrumentation production and build it up from there.
It seems to me that you might have quite a decent and consistent drive to, you know, keep working, keep improving in these creative fields. Do you feel like you've actually got a handle on your own creative power, in a sense, that you can keep consistently working on things and not burn out too much? Would you have any advice for people like me who spend too much time on YouTube doing nothing and not working on creative things?
I think that's a very difficult question because every creative mind has that inner self-doubt and the self-judge, and you definitely get to a point where you either want to give up or you believe you're not good enough, or you spend time procrastinating doing something else. I would advise to do what you actually enjoy, and that you'll definitely get somewhere. If you're actually enjoying what you do, then it's very important for progress.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Maybe I will get somewhere one day. I think it's time to talk about the two small nuggets of synthy news that we've got, and I do want to grab your brain on some synth stuff later as well. Mm-hmm. Only two that I've got today. Dreadbox Typhon. Did you buy a Typhon?
Oh, I'm still considering
it. It's a cool little box. We do love it. It's only just got USB MIDI because it never had that for some reason. And it's got audio over USB, which is super cool.
This is this new firmware update.
Firmware update. Couple of bug fixes.
That version 4?
It may well be. I don't know. But it's a cool little box. We like Dreadbox. And there's new stuff there if you wanted more tempting towards it. One that is going to be a YouTube thing for you. There is, of course, a Loopop video on this one. We do love our Loopop videos. The PolyEffects Hector. You know PolyEffects from the guitar world, I imagine, in some capacity, Terry?
Yes, I believe they do some guitar pedals.
I can't remember what they're called, but this one, Hector, is a touchscreen modular within a modular kind of environment. You know, you've got your basic LFO mixer VCA models. You've got effects processors, granular stuff, loopers, and all that. So there is a video on there if you are considering such a system. There's also Percussor SSP would fall into that category.
This is the Eurorack version of the pedal. Because I watched the Lollipop video.
Yes, but I'm trying to... What's the other one that I'm thinking... The one I borrowed from Dave. What's that called? With the grid of buttons. Empress...
Zoya.
That's the one.
Yeah, so
the Empress Eurobureau would be the third of that kind of crossfade, if you're wanting your... Not crossfade. I'm speaking random words today. Yes, Percussor SSP, Polyeffect Hector... Empress Eurobureau, and there might be a few others, but if you want that multi-effects modular within a modular, those are your three options. But there's a Lollipop video, so go and grab it if you are at all interested and have $599 to spend.
And you have to currently order it directly from them, and they're doing them in small batches, so batch 1 and 2 have already sold out.
Wouldn't surprise me. It's probably subject to the old silicon shortage, isn't it, this kind of thing?
I think batch 3 is going to be available around September time from what I saw, because I did have a quick look on the websites to see the price.
Well, those are the only two bits of synthy news, apart from the fact that there is a ModCaf on the 8th of September. Go find us on Facebook at the Modular Cafe. Aldershot self-plug there. Hooray! Terry.
Hello there.
Back to you for some synthy times. I'm wondering, again, if you have any favourite hardware synthesizers, maybe from you just played one this one time and it was a magical experience and you loved it and it's amazing and you want to buy the thing right now but you can't because it's retro and it's really expensive and that's really sad. Or you might have bought a plug-in and you think, wow, why on earth would I buy hardware? What's the point? Where do you stand on such things?
I use soft synths primarily, and I love
them.
Heart. I'm really sorry.
That's all right. Soft synths are great. What are your favorites?
The one that I use the most is Razor by Native Instruments.
I don't
and
know that
it's
one.
And an additive synth. It's
very interesting.
Yes, it's very, very great and very versatile.
Mm.
And I'd say the other one that I use quite a bit is the Monarch.
Oh yeah, when you need that classic flavour.
Exactly, absolutely. So those are my two favourite synth sounds.
That's really interesting. I would never have called an additive digital plug-in-y thing. I wouldn't have thought. How easy is it to use? I know nothing about it. I'm going to quickly Google the UI while
we're
at it.
Absolutely. The interface is very easy to use. As it's additive, you can literally just take out a compartment and add anything you want. It has a very great kind of like graphic interface, so you can actually see what's going on. And it's one of the clearest sounding soft synths. It has a lot of clarity. It has a lot of really cool effects that you can use. My favorite effect on it is a reverb. It has a very specific reverb.
Oh, yeah.
Like a unison kind of reverb thing.
Ooh.
Just makes it sound big.
What's a reverb when it's unison? Does it do some octave-y, D-tune-y type
I believe so. I'm not
stuff.
Too sure what it does, but it sounds like a chorus reverb and a very big, yeah, reverb sound.
Nice one.
Definitely check it out.
Yeah, it does look pretty cool. It looks like we've got potentially a wavetable-related sound source.
Mm-hmm.
Always good to find those lesser known ones. And yeah, Native Instruments, always great value, especially if you can get them on
absolutely.
The sales.
Absolutely, yes.
I have a bit of a confession in that
ooh.
Respect that
uh-oh.
All the stuff that I've ever finished properly, that's 100% finished and been mastered, has always been done entirely with soft synths, even though I own...
Even though you used... Did you use hardware synths to begin with?
I had hardware synths back in the day and then didn't because I was doing other things. Then about 10 years ago, I got seriously back into hardware because it's just so much easier with soft synths in respect to connectivity and get functionality and getting things going in the respect of writing, recording and finishing stuff. It's great to use analog and digital hardware, but it just adds so much more of a layer of complexity into the recording process.
Yeah.
And I've got good ideas out of hardware equipment, but I've never really finished anything that's hardware based. I don't know why, just the way it's turned out.
Would you say that hardware synths are more for a performance based scenario rather than a production?
Depends on the hardware. Some aren't really that practical in a performance situation, but
like modular, but that's the fun.
Yes.
Because it's so impractical.
I found with soft synths you can just concentrate on the writing side and the actual final production, and you're not caught up with why is this not talking to this and
exactly.
why is this
it
not-
makes editing so much easier. And at the end of the day, when workflow is the most important compartment of your job, then I guess that's quite important.
Yeah, so I can totally understand why you as a sort of working composer would lean towards using plugins.
Absolutely. absolutely. Yeah, I have tried using hardware synths for some stuff. Sometimes it works. If it's something simple that you're going to use it for, then fine. Other times it's just editing. Post-production is just so much long-winded with hardware synths.
Definitely need the flexibility.
Absolutely.
I've often, in the store, when I've been talking to composers, you know, occasionally we do get professional composers coming in, and the general message I have gleaned from most of them, it's all about speed. They have to get those ideas crystallized down and recording, and they can't be bogged down in the weeds with technical
issues. You only get given a few days to finish a project. When you get a brief, it's usually like 3 to 4 days, and you have to turn around quite a few different songs.
So it's time is the essence with it, that type of
more
work.
Down that kind of corner, the workflow and efficiency kind of thing. Can we pick your brains on what you're using? What DAW do you use? Sort of session presets, so you have a bunch of tracks with instruments that you can just grab and go.
I use Logic because it's nice and easy for that kind of stuff. Absolutely. I have a bunch of templates just throughout working with a bunch of different briefs. I've found a few different ways of literally just creating a template. When it's a song that has to be like just orchestral, then I've got it ready, got all the tracks ready to go. If it's something synth based, again, I'll have a bunch of tracks that I know where all the synths are going and so on and so forth. So templates are super helpful.
We like to get nerdy. Can you break your favorite one down for us?
My favorite one down.
If you have all of that stuff stored in your physical organic meat brain rather than on your hard drive, if you have one of those in your head.
In my
what's
head.
What's in there?
So a template within my head, not actually in my computer.
The one that you use on your computer, but if you can remember it.
If I can remember it, okay, fair enough.
Because we love to know exactly what plugins you're going, because we're big nerds.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. It's quite simple, actually. I use one specific one that's my favorite. I've actually created a multi-track on Kontakt, which is just a massive orchestra, so you can play the whole orchestra on your MIDI keyboard. And it has a few cellos, violas, violins, first and second, an organ and timpani, and cymbals. So I usually use that for like the bigger parts when something has to get like big and
the
huge.
Big, massive orchestral moment.
Yeah, so
I suppose that could be quite a key part of a composition. You're working up to that one particular emotional moment, and then you kind of work backwards and possibly outwards.
Yes, that's very true. Okay. You do usually start from the bigger part of the song, because most of the time you'll have to write a song that's 4 minutes long, maybe even less, like 3 minutes, and that trajectory isn't really a lot of time for you to work through different dynamics. So having one point where you know that's where the biggest part of your song is, you can then work around that and make it quieter or work towards that bit of the song.
Nice one. Was that a preset that you worked towards quite slowly and it's evolved over time, or do you have this one project like it needs to be big?
No, it actually took quite a bit of time to get to that point, because when I first started writing orchestral stuff, it was just for string quartets. That's how I got into it.
Interesting.
And from there, it expanded, and I added more and more instruments.
Yeah.
I never really worked with brass that much, so that was the hardest part to crack when writing like bigger orchestral.
Are you a guitarist stuff. First? That's your origin. How did you make that? I don't know your background, if it was guitar. Let's get some theory or what you did.
Well, my first instrument was actually the violin.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I really enjoy writing orchestral music.
So you have the familiarity already, so it's not a totally alien, you made a weird jump.
Yes, so I started off with the violin, and then growing up I played the tuba. And I also played the trumpet for a while. And then I got into guitar and rock and roll, and that's when I actually left the kind of classical background, which I do regret quite a bit, and then got back into it eventually when I started composing. And I was lucky enough because I had that initial idea of how the actual string instrument works.
You got to have that knowledge of the functionality and operation of an instrument to write it properly.
Yeah, to make it sound convincing with plugins, you do have to understand practically how the instrument works.
Yeah, it's like if you hear somebody who's a beginner at drum programming, for instance, they might make a drummer with three legs, double kick and hi-hat pedal going.
Precisely, it's very important for expression with strings. Because you can't add vibrato to an open string, and that will sound unnatural when you're writing for cello and violin and viola and so on and so forth.
Can you play Behind the Nut on a violin?
Behind the Nut?
Yeah. Because you can do that on a guitar. You can change the pitch by squishing behind the nut.
You can't play, you can't finger a note behind the nut, but you can bow behind the bridge.
Ooh, that's got to sound unpleasant.
It does, but it does have a really great effect. You can also use the bow upside down and use the wooden part of the bow rather than the actual hair.
Interesting.
And that is an effect that loads of composers use for thriller music. For thrillers and horror.
Yeah, have you ever seen one of those metal contraptions with all the long metal splines that you bow?
I don't remember what that's called. But that's
neither can I, but they are
a beautiful instrument, yeah. But the violin itself can do so many different sounds and noises because you've got two elements. You've got the bow, which is a piece of wood, and then the violin itself, which is also a piece of wood with strings.
I can't remember them at all, but I do feel like there's either a Spitfire or Native Instruments library that is... either piano played wrong, but right, or sort of the violin.
Yeah, I think it's the giant by Native Instruments.
That's got some bits on it.
It has a cinematic version of the giant, and it's like a prepared piano, essentially.
That's the phrase I was trying to remember that was on the fringes of the brain, prepared piano. Because I know Nils Fram's done a bunch of interesting stuff on that kind of corner. He tends to do something for Piano Day each year, I think, which is always a good listen. Here's another question, along the same lines again, but... like not adding vibrato to an open string, what other pitfalls would you advise a budding composer of? Potentially mechanical impossibilities of the instruments you're composing for, or don't make this piece too busy. Think about how a real orchestra works. Any little nuggets of advice that might pop into your brain like that?
I would say be very wary of, first of all, the range of the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of plugins will actually let you play outside of the range of the instrument, and that can sound very unnatural.
Yeah.
The other piece of advice would be to actually understand how the instrument operates. Like, how does a trombone actually make that sound, and how can you use different expressions within its own range? And the other thing would be, with orchestras, a lot of the time it's about what you can take away from the piece rather than what you can add. It's easy to go down the route of like adding constantly, adding more instruments, more parts, but then it just gets messy. So it's just a case of what can I take away for this to sound better.
Excellent. Always great to have an insight into the world in which I understand very little. That brings us towards the end of our podcast. As always, we end with the clumsily titled Miscellaneous Multimedia Recommendation, because I couldn't think of a recommendation synonym beginning with M. I've got mine ready. These are both second-hand recommendations from two people who've been on the podcast before. You may remember Sam Rushton, an ex-colleague. And
I miss Sam.
Oh, Sam, what a guy. Very talented drummer and excellent gentleman. He made an excellent discovery. A French... I think it's a just person and then session musicians type band called Igor with three R's.
Oh, I love that guy.
Yeah?
Yes, his stuff is insane.
It's so cool. So he first showed me Camel Dance Floor and then Very Noise, which I had seen the video before because it kind of been a bit viral. So Meat Department, who did Love, Death and Robots Season 2, the robot housekeeping thing with the dog and the creepy people.
Yep.
They did that episode, and they did a video for Igor, Very Noise. It's bizarre. But Camel Dance Floor is a really interesting mix of some electronic-y, dubstep-y, bassy moments, some world instruments, of which I can't identify because I'm not knowledgeable enough, and sort of proggy, metal-y stuff. And overall, it's excellent. It's a really good album. What is the album called? Spirituality and Distortion. Yeah, that sums it up, to be honest. A really good one. Igor, IGOR, or Igor, I don't know how to pronounce it. But the other one is a recommendation from our own Terremoto from Egypt. This is a song called Ithaca by a South African band called Beatenberg. Sort of a relaxed, funky, jazzy bit of reggae-ish, maybe. See, here we go. We're talking about those terrible descriptions of genres yet again. But really relaxed. It's just nice. Ithaca is spelled I-T-H-A-C-A. Beatenberg on whichever music streaming platform you desire. Pete, it's your time.
Right. I'm going to recommend just one video. It is on YouTube, and I can't really vouch for any other of the videos on this particular channel. The channel is called Sean Doran. I'll spell that. It's S-E-A-N. A-N, but the A's got a...
Is that...
Graph? It's got a little kind of thing. I don't know how you pronounce those A's when it's got a little thing. And then Doran, D-O-R-A-N. Now, the video, which I came across the other night, is basically entitled Orbit, Journey Around the Earth in Real Time. And this is the 4K remastered version. So effectively what it is satellite imagery or satellite video of a 90-minute orbit, which is approximately how long it takes, doesn't it, to orbit. Certainly that's how...
You can orbit as fast as you like, really, I suppose.
I think it's approximately how long the space station, the International Space Station takes to orbit is around 90 minutes. It is continuous in respect that it goes all the way around, but it's taken from different shots. So
different shots on the satellite or something?
Yeah, possibly, or taken at different times, perhaps. But it still is being edited together, so it's a complete orbit in one real-time go. Yeah. But so one shot may be looking forward, and then in the same point, they cut to a shot looking back. So I don't know if it was filmed at the same time or on a different pass of the satellite, or maybe a different satellite. But having said that, all the video all looks of the same quality and the same color grading. Anyway, there's no commentary. It's just this ambient music all the time, and it just runs for 90 minutes, and you can spend your time either just chilling out to it or looking up and occasionally trying to identify the land masses that are passing beneath. Nice. Which is not that easy.
Oh yeah,
you think you know the world really well, but because it's a strange orbit, it seems to start approximately at the sort of tip of Spain near Gibraltar and then cuts diagonally across Africa.
Oh, so you do get a bit of the poles as well.
Yeah, it's sort of a strange diagonal kind of...
Not an equatorial type thing.
Yes, exactly. Right. So it's not pole to pole, it's not equatorial, it's kind of diagonal. And because of the angles is approaching, I was struggling to actually identify some of the land masses that are passing over. But it's just a thing. Just kind of have it running in the background or just... Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, that's my recommendation.
Delicious. Terry, what can you leave our listeners with if they've got a bit of a boring week coming up?
I would like to recommend an artist from Poland called Hania Rani.
She is
H-A-N-I-A-R-A-N-I.
Nice.
And she is a classically trained pianist. She's got a few albums, and it's very minimal. Don't know if anyone likes Philip Glass here.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard a few. Very, very heavily influenced by that kind of wave.
Gotcha.
Check out a song called Glass, in fact.
Ah.
Yes. Yes, it's beautiful. And also would like to recommend a book called Upstream by Mary Oliver. It's a bunch of essays that she wrote about creativity, curiosity, and moments of eternity unveiled by The Simplest Things.
That sounds brilliant. I'm going to have to write that one down right now. Hey, where's my notes? Notes!
Tell me again. Upstream by Mary Oliver.
Lovely stuff. Upstream.
It's a beautiful book for the creative mind.
Well, you've never led me wrong yet. Beyond and Before was an excellent read.
That was a very good book.
It is excellent. Yes. It's so good. I lent it to my dad, and he likes music. Mm. He doesn't play or anything, but he found it really interesting too.
So much good information in there. Mm. Yeah.
Actually, there we go. Another recommendation, Beyond and Before, if you're into prog rock kind of corner in any way, shape or form. Well, thank you, of course, listeners. That's been episode 86 of Rack Addicts After Hours. We hope to catch you next week on the 87th.
Farewell.